Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, back from vacation. Jim Garrity is not here, though, today. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim. Let's go with our good, bad, and crazy martinis. We start with the good. And it's not often that former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley fits in that category. And we should preface this by saying what he's actually saying isn't necessarily good, but what he's doing in general here is good, because what you have, obviously, on the Democratic side, as long as Joe Biden keeps waffling about getting in the race, is it's Hillary Clinton's race to lose. And even though Bernie Sanders is doing well, it's been an odd dynamic in this campaign, because Bernie Sanders has said publicly he has no intention of criticizing Hillary Clinton, who is the runaway frontrunner in most national polls. Obviously, Sanders is doing pretty well in New Hampshire, and he's very competitive in Iowa. But after that, things look pretty dicey for him. So it's weird that he would say something like that. Martin O'Malley not saying that. After being very vocal about wanting more debates in the Democratic primary process, he's now criticizing Clinton on specific issues. He was on with Dana Bash on CNN over the weekend, and the first issue was Hillary Clinton's flip-flop on Trans-Pacific trade.
Hillary Clinton has shifted left on several policy issues over the past couple of weeks and months. The biggest was this past week on a pretty big trade deal that she had once called the gold standard.
Was probably an architect of. Let me tell you for my part that I was against the Trans-Pacific Partnership 8 months ago because I believe it's bad for the country. Thomas Jefferson once said that in matters of fashion, one should swim with the current, but on matters of principle, one should stand like a rock. I'm opposed to it, have been for a long time. I didn't shift positions right on the eve of the first Democratic debate.
Pretty good shot right there, although O'Malley could be accused of some selective obedience to the quotes of Thomas Jefferson. on to the second question, and that was Hillary Clinton's endorsement of a no-fly zone in Syria.
Secretary Clinton's always quick for the military intervention. I believe that a no-fly zone right now is it's not advisable, and this is why. No-fly zones sound attractive, but no-fly zones also have to be enforced.
Ian, we finally got some punches being thrown on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and it's about time. Part of this is with the debate coming up tomorrow, I believe. You know, O'Malley's sort of setting himself up to be the aggressor here. But look, if you're Martin O'Malley, you have nothing to lose and everything to gain. You're polling low. You're, you know, third in a race of extraordinarily weak candidates. So he wants to come out and set himself apart. And it's not only on TPP and Syria, but he said several weeks back the email story was legitimate and that we needed to be looking into it. So he's really trying to set himself up as, I think, the middle way, so to speak. If you're not a crazy Vermont hippie who wants Bernie Sanders, and if you're not someone who's going to sign on to this Arkansas grifter, here's me, Martin O'Malley, giving you a third option. And of course, that depends on Joe Biden not getting into the election, but that's O'Malley's play here. And, you know, who knows how that'll work out. It has a lot to do with, again, Biden, the FBI investigation into Hillary, et cetera, et cetera. But for Republicans, this is good. We want to be encouraging this. I think the farther Hillary's poll numbers fall, the more aggressive her opponents are going to be, the more nervous the DNC is going to be. You can already see that the way that they're trying to cut down on the number of debates, this little Tulsi Gabbard scuffle yesterday where she called for more debates and has been disinvited to tomorrow's debate. They're trying to hold water for this candidate. I think the farther she slips, the more aggressive other candidates are going to be. That's a primary bloodbath that is good for Republicans because it's going to weaken whoever the nominee ends up being.
That's a good point. And I think the other thing that happens when blood gets drawn by lower tier candidates is that Hillary's instinct will be to move left to shore up the base. But she has two problems with that. Number one, it's not her natural instinct. She's so politically calculating most of the time that by the time she does it, many others have already done it, and it looks calculating rather than somebody who actually sees where the base of her party is going.
Right, and O'Malley calls her out on this on TPP. Absolutely rightly. I mean, it's been greeted by everyone with universal cynicism. The same thing with her interview with Lena Dunham a couple weeks back. I mean, look, everyone knows that Hillary Clinton is ruthlessly calculating, that she doesn't believe in anything in particular other than what's going to win the next race. So by calling her out on that, he's exploiting, I think, a perception that a lot of people already have, including a lot of Democrats who in other circumstances would be willing to just hold their noses.
All right, on to the bad martini now. And the Benghazi committee a couple of weeks ago was in good position to ask some very tough questions of Hillary Clinton come next week. And they will still do that. But now there's a double cloud over these hearings and over this committee in general. First, of course, was the unforced error by Kevin McCarthy by suggesting that the whole point of the committee, at least in his clumsy language, was to get Hillary Clinton. Now, just before the first Democratic presidential debate, there is a whistleblower who is fired from the committee who is saying that basically it turned into a get Hillary Clinton operation. Here's Jake Tapper from CNN with the story.
This man says that committee's mission has changed and is now focused solely on how to put blame on former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, which the committee's Republican chairman, Trey Gowdy, has repeatedly denied.
I'm scared. I'm going up against powerful people in Washington. I was fired for trying to conduct an objective, nonpartisan, thorough investigation.
Major Bradley Podlyska was an investigator on the committee for almost 9 months before being fired in June. The Air Force Reserve intelligence officer is planning a lawsuit against the committee. He says he was dismissed in part because of the time commitment required by his duty as a major in the Air Force Reserves, but also, he says, for resisting pressure to focus his investigation on Hillary Clinton and her State Department.
This has become a partisan investigation. I do not know the reason for the hyper-focus on Hillary Clinton.
Podlyska is a conservative Republican who even once interned for the conservative Media Research Center.
I would just like to state that I am going to vote for the Republican nominee in 2016. I do not support Hillary Clinton for president.
Much different story, Ian, coming from Trey Gowdy, chairman of the House Select Committee on Benghazi, who said that when Podlyska was fired, quote, 1 month ago, this staffer had a chance to bare his soul and raise his claim. This committee was focused on Secretary Clinton in a legal document, not an interview, and he did not do it. He also said that Podlyska was the one who was unduly focused on Clinton and was actually asked to stop by committee staff before his removal. This is reported by the Washington Examiner. Quote, the record makes it clear not only did he mishandle classified information, he himself was focused on Clinton improperly and was instructed to stop, and that issues with his conduct were noted on the record as far back as April. So it's one against the other. Obviously, depending on where you stand on the Benghazi investigation is where a lot of folks are going to come down on this. The problem, though, of course, is that Democrats get more fuel for their fire. The media is going to eat this up. And for the most part, Trey Gowdy's defense is probably not going to get much airtime.
Yeah, that's right. Who knows? I'm always inclined to be initially skeptical toward whistleblowers, particularly given the peculiar timing of this revelation coming after McCarthy's gaffe. Also, you know, you look objectively at the information that is available to us from the Select Committee, and the vast majority has been unfocused on Clinton herself, and there's a lot of activity on the committee on a whole range of topics and persons and events and the rest. So if they wanted to go after Hillary more aggressively, they could already have done that. So if you look at the balance of facts here, it seems to suggest there might be more to this story than this whistleblower has alleged whistleblower is presenting. Either way, it's certainly harmful to the committee. This is exactly what Democrats have been looking for ages. McCarthy was sort of the first half of the rope, and this guy gives them another long stretch of rope with which they hope to hang this committee. And I am suspicious that Hillary will find a way not to testify. Her testimony is scheduled for the 22nd, I believe, if I have the date right, and that's supposed to be a public hearing. But look, now she can come and say, we have two strong indications that this is just a partisan hack job that's meant to discredit me as I run for president, and I'm not going to participate in this show trial. And, of course, that's the line the media is going to take. So this does a lot of harm to a committee that is genuinely trying to get to the bottom of a very significant question. There's no question that if this had happened under a President Bush, a Secretary of State, Colin Powell, or Condoleezza Rice, that a select committee would have been formed and Democrats would be baying for Secretary Rice to be before the committee.
And for anyone who doubts the genuine yeoman's work this committee has done, Chairman Gowdy issued an open letter to the ranking Democrat, Elijah Cummings, with a lot of the details about what they've learned from emails and other documents and other communications, the detailed bizarre involvement in formulating Libya foreign policy by Sidney Blumenthal and all sorts of other things. So if you can find that online, which should not be that hard, it's definitely worth a read. It's a long read, but very insightful about some of the details that have already been uncovered by this.
Yeah, absolutely. Sidney Blumenthal, genuine war profiteer, according to these emails. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary what they're finding from these new batch of emails that they're getting ready to release.
On to the crazy martini now, and we head to Iran. The news over the weekend, late on the weekend, is that Washington Post correspondent Jason Rezaian convicted. He's been held in Iran on trumped-up charges since July of 2014, charged with espionage. He's a dual citizen of the United States and Iran. He's married to a woman from Iran. She is still facing charges, although she's not still in jail. And this just goes back, Ian, to the fact that these hostages, of which Rezaian is essentially one, were not even really on the table with this Iran nuclear deal, the U.S. not willing to stick up for American citizens when it came to trying to desperately get this deal done. What's making this even more foul-smelling is that Iran won't even give details of the conviction or details of the evidence against Rezaian. And now this guy is looking at a seriously long time in the worst possible conditions in Iran in a judicial system that is just deplorable.
Yeah, absolutely. So I used the phrase show trial a moment ago. This is a genuine show trial. This is exactly what you would expect from Iran. It's what you got in Soviet Russia. I mean, Rezaian, based on the information that we can get, which is extremely minimal, was on trial for four charges that presented a maximum of 20 years in prison. He's been convicted on at least one of those. There's no sentence yet, so we're going to find out what happens. But just to give you a sense of the circus that's gone on, the evidence, quote-unquote, for his espionage activities are his application for a job with the Obama administration prior to going to work for the Post. He was rejected with a form letter. They used that as evidence that he was connected to the United States government. His attempt to get a visa through the American embassy in Dubai, that's evidence. All of this goes on behind the scenes. There are no transcripts, no reporters allowed into the courtroom. There's a gag order on his attorney, who, oh, by the way, is now also being tried on charges in Iran. He's been a subject of, quote-unquote, temporary pretrial detainment, which has now been, I think, 14, 15 months. And it's not just house arrest in Tehran. He's been in even prison, arguably one of the cruelest prisons in the world. I mean, this is Lubyanka-style torture. He's lost 40 pounds, according to the doctors who are allowed to see him, who are few. I mean, you run down the list. This is who the United States should be protesting vigorously to get back. And the reports that Kerry would mention it to Javad Zarif, who was Iran's liaison to the United States, and nothing came of that. It's because they know they can push the United States around. And with this, it's important to note that there are two other American citizens detained in Iran, Saeed Abedini, a pastor who I've written about for National Review, as well as Amir Hekmati, a Marine, who was convicted to a death sentence after a 15-minute trial. This is Iranian justice at work. Why we think we can trust these people when the stakes are so high on, you know, nuclear weapons and all the rest is it's beyond me.
The job of the government is to represent the people of the United States, and it's obvious getting this legacy deal done was far more important than standing up for American citizens who are being railroaded in Iran. And Jason Rezaian's brother issued a statement which says in part that this conviction follows an unconscionable pattern of Iranian authorities of silence, obfuscation, delay, and a total lack of adherence to international law as well as Iranian law. The Iranian government has never provided any proof of the trumped-up espionage and other charges against Jason. So today's vague statement on a purported verdict, while certainly disappointing to our family, is not surprising. Ian, on that sobering note, we thank you once again for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Sounds good. Thanks so much.
Ian Tuttle of National Review, and for Jim Garrity today. Jim will be back on Tuesday. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch.